It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our weekly look at Congress with Paul Singer. This week, we have a lot to talk about. The Republicans have swept the U.S. Senate, and they're crafting their new agenda.
First, though, we're going to focus in on Wisconsin. Last night, the state's Republican Party saw a string of successes that will strengthen their control in the state. Governor Scott Walker kept his seat with a clear victory than many polls projected. The attorney general race went to Republican Brad Schimmel, and Republicans held their ground in the state Senate.
Secretary of State Doug LaFollette was the only Democrat to win statewide office, keeping a seat he's held for four decades. Governor Scott Walker delivered an enthusiastic victory speech in West Allis last night, thanking God and criticizing the government in Washington.
WPR State Capitol reporter Sean Johnson joins us now to give us an overview of Wisconsin's midterm election results. It's good to have you back, Sean.
Hey, thanks for having me again.
So big wins for Republicans in Wisconsin last night. How big a win was this for the GOP, would you say, and for the conservative agenda?
I would say that it was pretty close to their wins in 2010, when we were saying, you know, that's a once-in-a-generation win for Republicans. And here they've come back, and Governor Walker had his third win in 4 years. You know, he's won now as a first-time candidate for statewide office. He's won a recall. He's now won re-election, and he won it, as you mentioned, by a wider margin than a lot of people were expecting. The legislature, even after 4 years of, having voters having a chance to look at their record, they gave the legislature larger Republican majorities in the Senate and in the Assembly, where it looks like Republicans may now have 63 seats in the Assembly, pending a couple potential recounts, and a margin of 19-14 in the Senate. So very big night for Republicans, very bad night for Democrats in Wisconsin. They really don't have much to point to. Their only winner statewide was Doug LaFollette for Secretary of State, who also withstood that wave year of 2010. But the bad news for Democrats is the Secretary of State has essentially no duties. So it's a win in name only.
Now, the governor's race was pegged as being incredibly close. The polls were neck and neck for most of the race. And still, this margin of victory last night for Scott Walker was almost 6 points. What do you make of that?
Well, I heard from a Democratic pollster a couple weeks before the election day, and Paul Maslin at the time was the only person I was hearing say, you know, don't be surprised if this thing is a lot wider of a margin either for Mary Burke or Scott Walker than everyone's predicting, because really over the past 10 years, we haven't had a barn burner of a close race in a statewide race, really since the John Kerry, George Bush presidential race of 2004, that typically in Wisconsin, people make up their minds toward the end and that margin gets bigger. And that's what happened yesterday. Walker was really organized down the stretch, I'll say that. He, after looking like he was sort of flailing and searching for a message kind of midsummer, did not have that appearance toward the end of the campaign. And, you know, he was an incumbent, and it was a midterm gubernatorial election, which both things bode well for Republicans in this election, and that just kind of came home there toward the end.
Who was responsible in terms of voting demographics for that 6-point win for Governor Walker last night?
In demographics, I can tell you I didn't have a chance to look over the exit polls in terms of age and gender, things like that. But looking at the map of Wisconsin and where the votes came, he won all over the place. I mean, he won counties that Democrats have to win if they're going to win a statewide election in Wisconsin. You know, for example, down in Kenosha County, he's done very well there. But for a Democrat to win, typically the pattern of success for Democrats is that they win counties like that. So Mary Burke did win a few more counties than Tom Barrett had in his two unsuccessful runs at Scott Walker. So she increased the Democratic map in that regard. On the other hand, we had record turnout in yesterday's gubernatorial race for a regular midterm gubernatorial race, but it was really Republican driven. Mary Burke actually received about 23,000 fewer votes than Jim Doyle received for Democrats in 2006. So I think Democrats have to go back to the drawing board here and think about what happened in this race and, you know, what do they need to do for 2018.
And how did the vote pan out in the governor's race in terms of independents and men and women voters?
I haven't had a chance to look at the exit polling yet. I know that Scott Walker, toward the end there, looked like he was doing well with independent voters and men voters. You know, that was that gender gap existed throughout the polling on this race. There was, you know, and from what I could tell, from what little I did see of the exit polling, Walker won men as expected. Mary Burke won women. But independents went toward the governor, and that accounted in part for his margin of victory.
Now, moving on to the state Senate, where does it stand, and what does it say that it was a long shot that Democrats would have taken the Senate, had a majority there, but what is the message, a takeaway here about Wisconsin state politics?
Well, I think a couple of the races that Democrats targeted, as you mentioned, were not too great for them by the numbers, and the numbers turned out that way. They wanted to win the 19th state Senate district up in Outagamie and Winnebago counties. Thought they had a good candidate there in Representative Penny Bernard-Shaber from Appleton, but she lost pretty handily to former Republican Representative Roger Roth. Democrats liked their candidate in Martha Lanning in the 9th Senate district in the eastern Wisconsin against Devin Lemahue. But that race wasn't close. I mean, it reflected the conservative nature of that district. And on a night when Governor Walker performed very well in those counties, other Republicans did too. In the 17th state Senate district in southwest Wisconsin, you know, if Democrats were ever going to have a chance, that would be a district where they should have done well, because Barack Obama won that seat with about 56% of the vote. But it was a fairly lopsided victory there, too. Howard Markline, the Republican, conservative, with 55% of the vote over Pat Bomhack. You know, that's one race, that one in particular, will probably be analyzed as to what went wrong, because you had an ugly Democratic primary there, and you had the Democratic minority leader of the Senate getting involved in that. That's not typical of the way races like that are run. I guess what Democrats will say is, look, there was a national wave election, and Wisconsin was not immune to that.
Now, one of the more closely watched races was for a seat in the U.S. House, and that was Tom Petri's former seat. What happened there?
Tom Petri's former seat, which is another one of those Republican seats, went to Republican Glenn Grothman, a different kind of a Republican for sure than Tom Petri. Glenn Grothman, regarded as one of the most conservative members of the state legislature, very outspoken and not a fan of Tom Petri, and I think it was mutual. Petri, not a fan of Glenn Grothman. He did not endorse Glenn Grothman, and Grothman was very prepared to run in a primary against Petri. So, you know, this is kind of a new type of Republican here in Glenn Grothman compared to Petri. He defeated Mark Harris in that district, 57% of the vote going to Glenn Grothman to 41% for Mark Harris, the Winnebago County executive. You know, that was not unexpected. We really don't have many competitive districts, congressional districts in Wisconsin. Every time they redraw the maps, it gets less and less competitive. And so they are there to protect incumbents, basically. And that's what happened last night.
Now, one of the big events on any election night is the victory speech or the concession speech. What did we see last night, both for Mary Burke and for Scott Walker?
I mean, you know, Mary Burke essentially told people, keep your head up. When, you know, you get knocked down, you have to get back up. Scott Walker's speech sounded very much like somebody who wants to be talked about as a candidate for president. He mentioned the word Washington 10 times in his speech, never in a flattering light. You know, he contrasted what we'd done here, in his words, to what they did in Washington. You know, he sounded like somebody who wanted to run for president. You know, normally in that stump speech that he gives, he'll attack Madison or say that, you know, the people in Madison want to keep more of your money, things like that. It was all about Washington last night. And even when he talked about the good things that they'd done in Wisconsin, his message often morphed to, in Wisconsin and in America we believe. You know, I think a lot of people heard that speech last night and said, yeah, given the victory that he just had and given the way he's talking there, it's not going to be long before he's going to be out campaigning in Iowa.
Sean, thanks a lot for joining us and catching us up.
All right, thank you.
We've been speaking with WPR State Capitol reporter Sean Johnson about last night's elections here in Wisconsin.
Republicans swept almost all of the country's most closely contested races last night and ended the midterm elections with a new Senate majority, a bigger majority in the House, at least 31 successful governor races with a few yet to be called.
Republican success was widely predicted, but not to the degree seen last night. We discussed previously on Central Time the possibility that a Senate majority might not be decided until the weeks after the elections, but that's clearly not the case now. Republicans flipped at least 7 Senate seats, although they only needed to take 6. To become the majority.
Maybe it's too soon to say, but now officially begins the 2016 campaign. Paul Singer joins us every week to give us a behind-the-scenes look at Congress. He joins us now. Paul, I imagine you're a little short on sleep, but thanks for joining us.
No problem, Rob. Talking keeps me awake.
So how did last night's results compare with what we were expecting?
Well, the stronger performance, I think, across the board for Republicans than we were expecting. We expected these races to be close. In many cases, they were not close. Republicans outperformed the polls in state after state, even in places where Democrats won or appear to have won, like in Virginia. Senator Mark Warner. It was stunning how close that race was. For most of the night, challenger Ed Gillespie, who nobody expected to win, was leading in the tally. So it was a wave. It was a Republican wave. The thought was they might win a little, but they won a lot.
So what are people pointing to as key factors that basically shifted every prediction one column over in this race?
Yeah, well, exactly. Obama, I think, is the biggest. If you look at the way the races were run, by and large, Democrats were trying to run away from Obama and talk about state-based issues. Republicans are trying to talk about Obama and national issues, and that appears to have really trumped. The Republican voters were very mobilized, very motivated to get out and vote against Obama. The Democrats were not particularly mobilized and motivated to get out and vote for the people who will support Obama, and the independents all appear to be breaking towards the Republicans. I think the president was the biggest factor in this race.
And there was a lot of talk from the media and from Republicans saying, oh, Obama's hiding. They're not putting him out there on the campaign trail. I know the second guessing begins now. Has there been thinking from Democrats yet? Like, well, we lost anyway. We might as well have had Obama front and center.
You know, what the interesting thing I've seen is from some of the progressive / liberal groups who are saying that what we should have done, the Democrats should have done, is run a more unabashedly and unapologetically liberal campaign. They should have embraced economic populism of Elizabeth Warren. They should have embraced Obamacare. They should have embraced, some of the things that a lot of the centrist Democrats were unwilling to talk about on the campaign trail. So, sure, second-guessing shall go on. I mean, I think the problem is, you're at a 40% approval rating for the president. That just hurts.
Now, this race isn't quite over. Louisiana still going on. You have to get over 50% to conclusively win. So they've got a runoff. What happens there now?
They'll have a runoff in December, first week of December. By all accounts, Mary Landrieu, the incumbent Democrat, had her best shot to win if she could get a lot of people to the polls yesterday and split, because at the moment there was 2 Republicans on the ballot, so she could split their vote and she might be able to win. She didn't get 50%. That means they go to a runoff with just the top two, that is her and Bill Cassidy, the Republican. By all accounts, Cassidy is far, far favored to win that race, and the Republicans will pick up another seat.
So big winners in the Republican Party now. Obviously, I guess Mitch McConnell has to be toward the top of that list. Not only did he win re-election by a bigger margin than people were predicting, he appears likely to be the Senate Majority Leader, one of his dreams throughout his career.
Yep, totally. I mean, Mitch McConnell just held a press conference where he looked like the cat who swallowed the canary. He was obviously very pleased, and he will be the Senate Majority Leader. And he was very measured in his remarks, and he's not talking about you know, ramming things down the president's throat just yet. He's talking about getting some stuff done, looking for places of agreement, and focusing particularly on reforming the procedures of the Senate to have more votes and have more open process, which is kind of interesting for those of us who are inside baseball kind of people.
Why is that interesting? I mean, bring it outside.
Yeah, I mean, well, the whole deal is, and it is true, the way Congress now functions, particularly the Senate now functions, the majority leader, Harry Reid in this case, decides they want to have a bill. The only way to get the bill moving and to avoid a filibuster is to just basically block all amendments, block all votes except one. There's one filibuster vote and one, and assuming that passes, there's one yes or no vote. That's it. The committees don't matter much. The amendment process no longer really happens. The appropriations bills don't get approved in the committees. None of the normal order of Congress actually takes place. That is what Mitch McConnell says he wants to reform. However, I will tell you that the reason that happens is because as a majority leader, the Senate is really unwieldy if you let everybody talk.
So how are things going to work now? You said McConnell said there might be a few things we can pass that maybe President Obama will sign. What kind of issues can they agree on maybe quickly next year?
Well, the Republicans and Obama actually agree on opening up some new trade deals, international trade deals. The biggest hurdle to that has been Democrats. They don't like them by and large, particularly because the unions don't like them very much. And the environmentalists don't really like them. So that's one that I think Obama could easily sit down with the Republicans and work out a deal. You might also have some deals on minor revisions to corporate taxes. You might even actually have some reforms and revisions to Obamacare. Obama said he would not, he said in his press conference that he will not allow a repeal of the law. But he did not say he is closed to any revisions or reforms. And Mitch McConnell said basically the same thing. A total repeal will never pass. But that doesn't mean there's nothing we could do. Maybe they can find some stuff to work on.
One idea I've seen floated is that maybe with Republicans in control of both houses, gridlock could go down. There are fewer parties. It might be easier to get a unified message coming out of Congress and thus easier to negotiate between the White House and Congress. Does that seem plausible?
Yeah, sort of. I mean, I think what ends up happening is that instead of having a roadblock between the House and the Senate that prevents things from getting to the president, now you have the roadblock basically between the Congress and the White House. The roadblock becomes the president's desk. I think what that means is that more Republican ideas will pass, because simply because more of them will get to the president's desk, and there's only so many he can say no to. Sooner or later, he's going to have to say yes. So, yeah, some stuff will move. Now, of course, the issue will be whether the Republicans can keep their own flock in line. Today, Mitch McConnell said, we will not shut down the government. We will not threaten the credit of the United States by blocking a debt ceiling increase. Those views might be a little bit controversial in his own caucus.
Now let's turn to two words, 20 and 16. There's talk here after the Wisconsin elections about where Governor Walker might go, whether he might run. You had pointed in the USA Today in a video online that Republicans after this election were quickly pivoting to critique Hillary Clinton. Talk about that.
It was really funny. I mean, Rand Paul tweeted a series of Hillary losers pictures. That's pictures of Hillary Clinton standing with Democratic candidates who lost. The Republican Party put out a press release this morning talking about how this race was a rebuke of the Hillary Clinton agenda. Starting today, the Republican Party is focused less on Barack Obama and more on Hillary Clinton, because they think she's the most likely to be the Democratic presidential candidate, and they're going to start tackling her now.
A big name on the Republican side who was going state to state was New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. A lot of the candidates he backed won. Is there talk about him now in 2016?
Yeah, totally. I mean, a good night for Chris Christie. You know, if his job as the head of the Republican Governors Association was to protect and prop up endangered Republican governors like Scott Walker, like Rick Scott in Florida. And by the way, if you're going to run for president in 2016, not a bad thing to make friends and raise money in places like Wisconsin and Florida. I think Christie has clearly strengthened his hand for a possible 2016 run. He's a winner.
Briefly, as we wrap up, Paul, in 2008, big Democratic wins. People thought Republicans were out for a long time. They came back in 2010. There's talk of what's wrong with the Democrats. And so back and forth, back and forth. Is there anything about this election that makes you think Republicans are up, Democrats are down for a longer term this time?
No. But in fact, in 2016, the playing field favors Democrats significantly because a lot of the seats that are up are Republicans in Democratic states. So I think the House is more interesting and more sort of locked in. Wouldn't be surprised if Republicans have the majority there for a while. But then again, you know, a giant Democratic wave with a really successful presidential candidate might repeat the Obama successes of 2008. Everything turns on its head.
Well, I look forward to that conversation with you in 2 years, Paul, and to another one next week, looking in the shorter horizon.
But first, I'm going to go take a nap.
All right. Get some sleep. That was USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. We've been talking election results, but he joins us every week at this time to give an inside look at what's going on in Congress. According to the United Nations, more than 800 million people around the world are chronically undernourished.
And it's likely to get worse. The UN estimates 3 billion people will join the global population over the next 40 years. And unless agricultural output increases by at least 60%, a lot more people will be going hungry.
Amid this dire news, one apparent bright spot, small farmers are stepping up. According to the UN's recent State of Food and Agriculture report, they produce more than 80% of the world's food.
Small farmers will be in the spotlight this weekend at Growing Power's third National International Urban and Small Farms Conference in Milwaukee.
To kick off that conference, Will Allen, the founder of the urban agriculture organization Growing Power, is teaming up with environmental journalist and food activist Michael Pollan for a conversation about the challenges facing our food system.
Will and Michael are with us now. Will Allen is an urban farmer. Besides founding Growing Power, he's also a MacArthur Genius Grant winner and the co-author of The Good Food Revolution. Will, welcome to the show.
It's great to be talking to you this afternoon.
And Michael Pollan is one of the leading voices of food and food politics in the United States. He's the author of The Omnivore's Dilemma and is a professor of journalism at UC Berkeley. Michael, great to have you along as well.
Good to be here, Veronica.
Well, Michael, give us a brief overview of where our current food system stands and the challenges that will be facing the world as it attempts to feed its population.
Well, our food system is in crisis. It's not doing the bare minimum you want from a food system, which is to feed everybody and keep everybody healthy. You alluded at the top of the show to the fact that there are 800 million people who are hungry and food insecure. At the same time, there are about a billion people who are overfed, overnourished, and struggling with obesity and type 2 diabetes. So we've got problems in both directions, and they're caused by similar things, I think, which is, you know, we're very good at growing commodity crops, corn and soy and wheat and rice, and less good at and a lot of that food ends up feeding animals and getting turned into junk food. But we're not so good at putting real food on people's plates. And so I think that, you know, there are a whole lot of problems associated with the food system going forward. And productivity is only one of them. It may be that we have to step up the productivity of agriculture. But we have to think about, you know, feed the world, yes, but feed the world what? And who feeds the world? Is it us feeding the world, or is it about the world learning to feed itself?
Now, Will, you've been tackling these problems on a small scale, starting with Milwaukee, and your ideas have been replicated elsewhere. What do you think some of those solutions are, city by city?
Well, first of all, Michael, it's great to be talking with you again.
And, yeah, I'm looking forward to our conversation Friday, too, Will.
And I think Michael has really, you know, talked about what the issues are that we face. And what we've been doing, of course, is developing a local food system, because I believe the only way to end world hunger is to do it on a local level. And our work has been pretty much to inspire people to go into action, to be able to grow some of their own food. Of course, the best case scenario is for folks to grow food in their backyards and side yards, a percentage of their food. But also the big challenge we have is to grow farmers. We have to grow new farmers. Average age of farmers is 65 years right now, and we will have to replace those farmers. But like Michael said, we need to grow good food, not just what some of us consider food, but really good food. And most of our food today is not good food. So that's part of the problem. But there are, I'm encouraged because of so many young people that are interested in the food system today. As I travel the country and speak at universities and community-based organizations, more and more young people are interested, and they'll fit into the food system at some place. They may not all be folks that are going to put a plant in the ground, but there's hundreds of jobs in the food system that they can fit into, and of course be consumers of good food. So I think that's part of what my work is all about today.
And Michael, if you agree with Will about the need to grow new farmers and young farmers, how do we do that? How do we get young people interested in having not only a stake in just eating good food, but in producing it? And that's that is a viable and noble way of life.
Well, you know, Will is doing a lot of that work. He's doing a lot of training. I mean, I've known many young people who've gone to study with him at Growing Power and been inspired by the experience and gone back to their communities and begun farming. You know, one of the ways we encourage people to farm is by revaluing farming. In this country, we denigrated farming for many, many years. You know, it was official policy, really, to reduce the number of farmers, take people off the farms and move them to the cities. And, you know, farmers were the butt of jokes in this country for decades, and that's changing. I think the prestige of farming is rising dramatically, and that's one of the reasons you see more young people getting into it. I've had the same experience as Will. I speak on a lot of college campuses. And for the millennial generation, for the generation of people now in college, food is a calling. Farming is a calling. And it's true, they're not all going to become farmers, and some of them are going to crash and burn. It's really not an easy, it's not easy to get in if you don't inherit farmland. But it's very exciting to see this generation embrace this issue, and we have to give them incentives. I mean, we have to figure out ways to get them on the land. We need programs to connect people who own a lot of idle land with farmers who want to cultivate it. We need financing to help them get started. We need, say, land trusts who are sitting on lots of land, making it available to young farmers. So we have to get really creative. The government, too, can help by making it possible to get people on the land. But the demand is there, the demand for the food that they will grow and the demand on the part of young people to get onto the land. And, of course, we need to train them in our ag schools. Many of the ag schools have had a really exclusive focus on very large-scale industrial operations. And you're starting to see the rise of small farm programs, sustainable agriculture programs in the ag schools. And that's a development, I think, that we need to encourage.
Well, can you make the case that there are benefits health-wise and to the food systems themselves to bringing people in closer contact with the food that they eat? So it's not something that you just pick up at a drive-thru or even at a grocery store, but something that you grow with your own hands.
Yeah, and I think it. We have to attack it at all levels. For example, we put in 50 daycare gardens. Many of these kids at the daycares live in high rises. They don't have an opportunity. They've never tasted anything organic, so this gives them an opportunity to develop their taste buds. But we have to attack it at all ages, with K through 12, and of course, I just came back from Texas A&M University yesterday, where they're putting in a student garden. So, like Michael said, it's happening all over the country, and it's being led by a lot of young folks, a lot of community-based organizations, and many of the universities are now getting on board with having sustainable degree programs. So that's encouraging to see. I know at the University of Minnesota, they just put in a sustainable degree program. So that's something that will start to happen at our colleges. The thing that we have to do is be patient, because, and I'm sure Michael will agree with this, the industrial food system isn't going to go away overnight. But we need to be able to give people choices of to be able to go into a grocery store and to be able to have a choice to buy something that's local, something that's natural or organic. And right now, that's very difficult to do. You may spend a couple hours trying to find organic labels, but to be able to walk into a grocery store and have a section, a 20-foot section with a big sign that says locally grown, that would be a big step. And that's something that several retailers here in Milwaukee have been able to do. And I think that's part of it, the continual education of all of us, because when we have our workshops from January through June, somebody from so many different disciplines show up. There are folks that are early retirees, there are young people that show up. There are folks from corporate companies that show up. So we're starting to see this movement grow. I know Michael and I had this conversation several years ago about this being becoming a revolution, which I named my book, The Good Food Revolution. And it really is now, because I remember when 21 years ago when I started doing urban agriculture, where you'd go to a meeting and there would be 10 people. Now you go to meetings and there may be 100 people, like last night at A&M when the entire arena was filled. And I know when Michael goes out and talks, thousands of people show up to listen to what's going on and try to educate themselves and learn. So there are a lot of very positive signs happening, but with more and more people moving into cities around the world and close to cities, we have to figure out how to reduce the production cost, how to use renewable energy, get away from fossil fuels to be able to grow our food, how to grow soil, because our soil is contaminated. Whether you're in a rural area with GMO farming, whether you're in suburbia where we spray our lawns, and of course all the contaminants in the soil in our cities. So one of the things that we've done is to be able to grow soil to compost on a fairly large scale. Last year, 40 million pounds of inputs into thousands of yards of compost to be able to grow this healthy food, because it's really all about the soil.
We're talking right now about the challenges facing our food production systems and the role of small farmers in providing enough food for the future, and talking about whether or not we are in the midst of a good food revolution.
And we want to hear from you. What do you see as the biggest challenges in feeding a growing global population with good, healthy food? What solutions do you see to food insecurity, especially in poor communities? And are you a small-scale farmer? Maybe you just got into it. Where do you fit into this conversation?
We're continuing our conversation about the state of our food production system and about the role of small and urban farmers in providing food for a growing global population.
And you can join the conversation. How do you see the state of food here in the United States? What's the role of small farmers? How can we continue to provide enough food, or start to provide enough food, for the world's growing population? Call with your thoughts and your questions at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Michael Pollan and Will Allen are with us. Michael is an author, a leading voice on food politics in America, and a journalism professor at UC Berkeley. Will Allen is a farmer, founder, and CEO of the urban agricultural organization Growing Power and a MacArthur Genius Grant winner. And we're going to go to our phones first. We've got Mike joining us next in Rice Lake. Hi, Mike.
Hey, good afternoon. Thank you for the topic. It's inspired me. I've been following Mr. Allen's progress for years, and I tried a few chickens and backyard garden. This summer I amped it up to some hydroponics. And my question is, how much food can I expect to grow on my own? I'm working full-time. I've just got a little backyard. You know, how significant of a contribution can I expect to get from a garden?
Okay, great question, Mike. And let's see, why don't you take a swing at that first, Michael, and if we want, Will can chime in as well. What do you think?
Well, you know, it depends on how much land you have, obviously, and how much time you have. I'm always struck at how much I can grow. I now live on a very small postage stamp lot in Berkeley, and all I have for vegetables are three raised beds. Nevertheless, for most of the year, I happen to live in California, there's something to contribute to my meal, my evening meal, in that garden, whether it's a salad, kale, you know, peppers, tomatoes, and I'm not self-sufficient, and I have no desire to be self-sufficient, but I am providing partly for myself, and that is, I think it's a big deal. It really depends on, you know, your situation and how much time you want to put into it, how much you can get out. But even a little bit is significant in a lot of ways. I mean, one is you are reducing your reliance on the big system. On another, you're improving your soil if you're gardening well, and you're sequestering carbon, and you are getting the healthiest, freshest, most nutritious food you can possibly have. And you're getting it all for virtually free. I mean, there is your effort, and there might be the price of some soil amendments now and then. But, you know, when people talk about how can we have access to organic food, it's so expensive. Well, one way is to grow some of it yourself.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that call, Mike. And very briefly, Will, because we have a lot of folks who want to talk to you both. Did you want to weigh in on Mike's comment there?
Yeah, I think it's important to grow a percentage of your food. If it depends, again, like Michael said, on the size of your backyard or side yard or front yard or balcony. But it's really important to be able to grow, but also to grow it in healthy soil, whether you have to go out and purchase some really good compost, preferably from an organic farmer that sells some compost, or that's what we do at Growing Power. We sell compost, and we install gardens in people's backyards and so forth. But it's important, and to be able to extend the season by using some hoops over your garden to extend the season. And certain things like kale and collards and winter hardy crops you can grow year-round, even in a climate like Wisconsin. So I think that's important, and that's what a lot of people are starting to do, is put hoop houses and greenhouses in their backyard because they're that concerned about what they put in their body. And it's a best-case scenario if you're able to grow your food and you can pick it and eat it that same day or the next day. It's much better than much of the food that gets shipped from far away, that sometimes it's 10 days or even longer before you get it into your belly. So it's really important to be able to grow as much as you possibly can and have fun doing it.
All right. Well, let's take another call here. Andrew joins us next in Stevens Point. Hi, Andrew.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
Yeah, I was just wondering what impact, if any, the 2014 Farm Bill had on small and urban farming. Answer off the air.
All right. Thank you, Andrew. Michael?
Well, you know, there's a couple. The Farm Bill is always a mixed bag, and there's always some very retrograde material stuff in it, and then always a few glimmers of light. One of the most encouraging things in the Farm Bill is that for the first time, we have crop insurance that's designed for diversified farms. For most of the history of crop insurance, you've had to buy a policy for each crop. And if you're farming sustainably and in a really diversified way, you're going to have 20, 30, 40 crops. And you can't take out a policy on every single one. So now we have crop insurance for diversified farms. And I think that that's going to be a great boon to people growing fresh produce locally. So that's what I would point to as my point of light. Will, were there other stuff in the bill you thought was helpful?
Yeah, I think there was a little bit more money in there for farmer training and, of course, for development of farmers markets.
Mm.
So I think those two things. But what we have to do in the future to prepare for the next farm bill, one of the things that we really have to do is set up a policy office for urban agriculture and small scale farmers. I think there's kind of a big hole in the Farm Bill for those small farmers that are trying to get some funding. And I think we need to be able to poise ourselves for the next Farm Bill by having an office that we can send some folks up on the Hill and be able to compete to be able to get some of those, some more money into the system, because that's the only way we're going to really be able to grow the system a lot faster. Because sweat equity is one thing, but when you're up against is a very competitive field we're involved in, and with the dollars, and we need to be able to get some of those dollars into the next farm bill.
Now, you both expressed grave concerns about our food system and how it will work globally to feed all the mouths that we need to feed. Michael, starting with you, what is your vision for a new system of food production and distribution that will feed the people it needs to feed, not harm the environment, and be sustainable?
Well, I think we have to regionalize or localize the food system to a considerable extent. Having a globalized food system is a very risky proposition. It's a very brittle way to do business. And we, as we saw in 2008, where you had some bad harvests in a couple places and a bunch of Wall Street speculators driving up the cost of wheat, and it led to revolutions and hunger in many places. And, you know, if your food economy is dependent on Wall Street and on decisions made by governments you don't get to vote for, you're vulnerable. And so I think that, you know, it was a real wake-up call to a lot of countries that they needed to have a little more control over their food system, that they maybe wanted a grain reserve to protect against price shocks. And there is also the fact that, you know, the kind of food you can trade globally tends to be these commodity crops that don't really give us much besides, you know, energy and fat. They don't really give us what we need from real food. And they're very often things like corn and soy get turned into junk food. And that certainly travels well, but that's not what we need more of. So I also think we do have to increase the productivity of small and subsistence farmers around the world. But people they kind of think it's a choice between a hyper-productive corn and soybean farm in the Midwest and slash-and-burn agriculture. And there's a lot of agriculture in the middle. You know, you said earlier, 80% of the food in the world is being grown by small farmers, all of them with some smart agronomic decisions and better soil health could vastly increase their productivity without moving into this fossil fuel-based, environmentally destructive system that we've perfected in this country.
And I wish we had more time, but we're out of it right now. Will and Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Veronica, and I look forward to continuing the conversation with Will on Friday.
Great. And Will, thanks a lot to you. That was Will Allen, and founder and CEO of Growing Power, Inc., and Michael Pollan, author, food activist, and professor of journalism at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism.
You can catch them and many other speakers at Growing Power's third National International Urban and Small Farms Conference, taking place at the Pottawatomie Hotel and Casino. For more info, go to growingpower.org.